Welcome to another episode of Convos and Cocktails. I'm your host, Lesego Tlhabi, and this is the place where we get to drink, we get to learn, we get to laugh. I say a different introduction every week because, that's just how it's going to go. Today's guest is Aunt Louisa. I don't know if I should call you Louisa for the purposes of this podcast, but I feel like you can just be Aunt Louisa.
Perfect.
Okay. It's Aunt Louisa Zondo. She is the author of Dearest Mariki, A Mother's Journey Through Grief, Trauma, and Healing. She's an activist. You're a lawyer. You're a lot of things. But you're also an auntie, and that's why I wanted to speak to you today about your book. And you happen to be the late rapper Ricky Rick's mom. So first, before we start, what is your cocktail of choice today?
Well, I don't even know, Sicho, whether this is a cocktail, but the drink that I go for when I'm having happy drinks, so to speak, is a cider.
Okay.
I would go for a cider, but I would request that it be mixed with some ginger, pure ginger, and lots of lemon.
Okay.
Lots of ice. So that must
be a
cocktail.
We're very similar that way. I'm a cider and ice person. The ginger and lemon, not so much, but I love a cider and ice. So thank you very much. Cheers, and welcome to Convos and Cocktails.
Cheers.
Oh, just the way I like it. Actually, I must just call this like drinks and conversations at this point, because the next few episodes, the people are like, not really a cocktail person. I don't know if it's an age thing. You guys, like, the mumsos are coming soon. So it's like, nobody wants to have cocktails.
Yes.
So, and Louisa, today we're going to talk a little bit about grief. It is a happy place and a happy drinks place. And I know that obviously it's been over a year since Ricky's passing. So I don't want to keep you in that space. I think you've done a lot of book tours, a lot of conversations on it.
Yeah.
But I was just talking today on Instagram about grief because a very famous actor passed away yesterday. And I have very big nightmares about the passing of family members. I don't think I'm a person who feels like they can handle grief or will know how to go through it. So a lot of people were sharing their stories, but also asking a few questions. And obviously you're not an expert on it, but having recently gone through the grief, I thought maybe you could answer some questions, speak a little bit about your grief, but also if there's something on the other side, where there's joy, where there's moving on, where there's an ability to just laugh again.
Yeah.
So first and foremost, if you would like to, can you share with us the story of why you wrote this book? Oh, and this is the book for everyone who's watching.
I think the main reason I wrote the book was for the healing. It was for my healing. It was for me to contribute possibly to the healing journeys of others. But I had for a long time known that there are things in me that were sitting in a place of disconnect, confusion, brokenness, just not being healthy. And there was always a sense in me that it probably would be healed by me writing the stories, me telling the stories about me, about life, and just how I encounter things. I knew that even before Ricardo passed, I knew that, and I wanted to write, but I couldn't tell my stories. I couldn't, even to myself, I couldn't do that. And so when I finally got to a place where therapy processes helped me to go into myself, gave me some tools to look at myself, to understand myself, to forgive a lot of stuff that had happened in my life, I found that I could start writing. And that's how eventually that writing became the book. And so I would say to you, I wrote for the healing, and I always knew that my writing would be for my healing, healing of my family, healing of the stories that were tormenting my life.
Okay, so I mean, when I read the book, you know, it doesn't just obviously talk about that chapter, which was a big part of the reason why you wrote the book or why you went to therapy, but you start when you were young. And so I want to just talk about some of the stories from before, because I think one of the important things that I learned from reading your book is just how much of our mom's stories we miss.
Yeah.
There is a lot about you that is a whole person before you were a mom and before you were a grieving mother. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to go back to the beginning, because in your book, you spoke about your days as a child and how strict your parents were, and do you think that had any sort of dealings with how you were as a mom, but also how you were as a person?
The way I was raised shaped me right from the beginning, this awareness of what proper is, and the awareness that you better be proper if you are going to be loved. And that's a skewed awareness, but that's how my framing of what life is became from the time when I was little. And so that was a significant part of the lessons from being raised in the environment I was raised in, the way in which my parents loved, the way in which my parents cared and protected, that it led me in that direction. And I was a child who really wanted to please.
That's so really crazy wanted to me, because as an auntie, you seem like one of the more, I say, free-spirited ones. Like, it definitely was that. I mean, you've got a nose ring, first and foremost. But even growing up, I was always like, she's the cool aunt, definitely proper and rules and pleasing. Yeah. I would never have put with you.
Yeah. And those things stand in contradiction. They stand right through in my life. You'll see there is the contradiction between the one who must comply and obey the rules and the one who seems to do the most outrageous, unexpected, most impulsive actions. So I think they are two sides of the same thing. And it does have to do, some people who like the language of attachment, like this, it has to do with the way in which my attachment was shaped. I did do outrageously unconventional things, and I thrived from that. But in all of that, I also had this yearning to please. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you pleased us as nieces and nephews, like I said. So one of the other things that you spoke about also in your book is obviously your career. I don't think I ever knew what exactly you did or what any of the aunties did. Yeah. But actually, before we even get there, the varsity journey, because that's where she brings up my mom. Yeah. I love the story so much. I needed to bring it up at the podcast. I know we spoke about it a little bit, but the story when you were speaking about Penny, you know, teaching you chastity, because sleeping in jeans means, well, next to your boyfriend means that nothing is going to happen that night. Yes. So how did your friends feel when you brought up stories about, I guess, them in the book and your history together?
I think the book gave all of us permission to look at our lives and allow the truths that we had held up to the point where we were reviewing anew these things to emerge. Not those to emerge, but those to move aside for other realities to emerge. Mm-hmm. We had at various points to different extents exchanged stories of our lives, but I don't think we had taken the opportunity to fully share what the implications of those experiences would have been in our lives. For example, then with the story about how these 16 and 17-year-olds who go to university are going to manage the pact that is nicely sealed in high school that good girls do not lose virginity before 21. How they're going to manage this now at university, that was a big thing. And so when Penny and I become almost amongst the first who have boyfriends, this becomes reality now. And then I do have the conversation with your mom, Penny, about how these things are managed.
It's also funny because sometimes you think your parents tell you something because they don't want you to make the same mistakes, but it actually seems like Penny was telling the truth. Okay.
Yeah, she was telling the truth.
So why did some of the stories that you decided to mention come up? How did you decide to put, because a life that is almost 60 years or beyond 60 years has got a lot of stories. How did you decide that these were the ones that were going to shape the chapters in this book?
Because there are so many stories, I had put together just a framework of what I will touch in the book. And I had looked at different, I won't call them epochs, but different time periods in my life. And I had things to say about that. But in the writing itself, so much came up. And so even after the book has come out, I am sort of allowing myself to go deeper into other stories and allow the implications of those to sit with me as well. And I am opening myself up to continuing on my own journey of healing. A lot is coming up, a lot. And so I did not consciously censor, nor did I consciously select particular stories that fit a particular energy that's coming through in parts of the book. It just had to do with an old one trying to remember stories of old and putting them in a framework for the book. Yeah. Yes, and memory then goes in a particular direction, and a lot has surfaced since the writing. Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously you weren't an author before, you are an author now, but how did the process of actually writing go about? Was it just like in one kind of go? Or were you approached by, you know, publishers and then kind of got onto the writing part?
My writing process was actually messy, if I could call it that, because short of 3 weeks before, after Ricardo had passed, no, it was already 3 weeks after Ricardo had passed, I walked up Mount Everest to base camp. And in that process, I was posting my conversations with Ricardo, and all of them were in sort of a letter format. Dearest Mariki, this is what I'm experiencing now. This is what I'm remembering. These are the thoughts that are coming up, feelings and all of that. I was just writing and sharing that publicly. When I got back, the feedback from just that primarily was, thank you. Thank you for sharing, because this allowed me to engage with my grief, which is this old, that old. It's about many people who had lost children said, it sort of felt like it's a way that I could also open up the things that were hard for me to open up just by engaging with my child. And I thought, oh, well, I've written this. And some people were just saying, thank you, I found it beautiful to read.
Yeah.
And so I thought, oh, then maybe, yes, a book could come from it. And at that time, my husband, Kumi, had finished writing his book. Mm-hmm. And it was published in November. And I almost had an experience of the writing process by observing him. Mm-hmm. So it sort of felt like, oh, it's attainable. And so he actually put me in touch with his publisher, and we submitted a framework for the book. And I had thought that from the period of July, when we submitted the framework and the publisher accepted, from July to September, I thought I would have the manuscript in, it would all be done, but it wasn't to be, because I still had that process that I needed to go through. And that process was the opening up of myself to myself. And it was only after I had been through more than 6 months of therapy. No, it wasn't 6 months. Yeah, more than 6 months of therapy that I really was able to start writing. And then my writing was also going to be quite difficult. So I got the assistance of a wordsmith who sat with me with the framework and allowed me to speak. Okay. And so that from speaking about the different parts of the book, I then had pages played back to me after Hagen Angler had put what I had told him as stories into written words. And that's what started me writing. I then put my writerly voice into it.
You segued quite nicely yourself into sort of the story of the grief part of it. So if we can just speak about sort of the day that, you know, because I don't really think people articulate or know how to articulate what grief is like. So from sort of the first day that you found out that Ricky passed away, what was that experience like and what happened on that day?
I still don't think I can really articulate what happened to me in those moments from the time when Bianca calls me just before we started that strategy session that we're going to have at Oxfam, with Oxfam South Africa in Centurion. And she calls me to say, Mama, I'm afraid, please come. I can't access the studio, and I'm afraid, please come. Something may have happened to Ricardo. So when she communicated those words to me, I obviously had to continue. I had to take action from there. First thing I do is to tell Nancy, a colleague who was sitting just next to my desk, and I tell her that a family member is in trouble. I'll need to go, but I'll come back soon. And I'm telling B, just hold on to prayer. God is with us all the time. Christ is with us all the time. And I have to get up. I did not drive to the venue. Now I have to gather my thoughts about what to do now. So I now go back and talk to the person who was responsible for logistics about needing to go. And they call back a car that had just dropped off somebody, and it comes back and I get a lift. Now in that process, I have to be on my feet. I have to be on my legs. I have to be commanding my brain not to shut down. I have to command my legs to carry me walking outside. I'm telling people, I'm just going to deal with a family member who's in trouble. I'll come back as soon as things are settled. And of course, on the way, this is when I get the news. And this young man is driving me to an address. He doesn't know why I'm moving away from the venue. Yeah. And suddenly he has this bellowing noise. And I can imagine in that traffic, I can imagine the shock he gets into. And then I do realize, though, while I'm sitting at the back, I do realize that I'm traumatizing a child. And I then sound the words, my son is dead, you know? And I see and I hear a huge sigh from him, but we continue. Then there's news that he's being taken to the hospital. And this comes as I am calling Ricardo's aunt, Makhadzi Denga. I'm calling her to tell her what has happened. The thing that is most hard to explain is that from that moment when I get the news, it's almost like I went away. It's almost like, but at the same time, there is the me that is also thinking on next steps, on process, on calling. I need to call Shegani. Shegani, are you there? I need to call, what about the boys? I need to call Makhadzi. I need to ask her, are you sitting? Are you? She says, yes, I'm on the bed. And then I tell her the news. But while I'm still in there, I said, hold on, because there's a call coming in. This is the call now, which informs me that they are taking him to hospital. And it gives me hope that, oh, we're going to hospital. I tell the young man who's driving, please, let's go to the hospital. We're no longer going to that venue. And he drives me there. But from the moment when I get out of the vehicle which was bringing me to hospital, I get the last call, and it's from my eldest son, Shegani, and he says, I didn't make it. And I fall flat on the ground, lay prostrate like that. And that's now on the Waterfall Hospital entrance space. And there's this rush that happens, and for a second I'm off, I'm just on the ground like that. And then when I come to, I'm hearing the voice of somebody saying prayers and calling on Jesus, and this, and then I feel this hovering over me, and it turns out it's this young man who was driving me. As he was turning around, he had seen me just fall on the ground like that, and he had stopped the car and come over to me. And so this is happening at casualty. Where they are and where they had brought Ricardo is in the emergency section, some 150 to 200 meters away.
Yeah.
And I see where I must go. And they bring the wheelchair to try and take me somewhere. But I cannot imagine that. Mm. And so I tell them that, you see, over there, they are young people. I need to be there for them. They've just been shattered. So I need to walk to them, and I need to be there for them. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that happens. There is a sense that I don't know anything, but there's also a sense that these are the things that must happen. I must be on it. I must be on it. And so holding those two is in itself shattering. So I will be there in the day, engaging with people, letting them know what is happening, what's happened, comforting, receiving comfort, just being there. But all the time, everything in me says, I don't even know what's happening here. I don't even know. And for me, the nights were even the hardest, because now it's quiet. At least with activity, you know, there's this confused state, but it's activity. Mm-hmm. In the night, there I just am like, all is gone. Mm-hmm. All is gone. All is gone. Like, it's almost like in the night I felt like this is what it is to die. And I then resorted to going into Ricardo at night. I would go into videos, I'd go into music, mm-hmm. I'd go into interviews till early morning, and then I wake up and do the activities that are involved with just what we had to do on a day-to-day basis. The thing about that period was that I did cry but it also felt like I couldn't fully understand what I needed to do. And so when in the second day I felt I couldn't breathe, I felt I had it, my chest was all tied up. Yes. I thought I was dying, actually. And when I went to hospital, the doctor's assessment was that I would have, you know, gone into some spasmic thing in the chest, and they just had to relax the chest muscles, and that helped. But what I couldn't do was to take any of the sleeping medication, the sedation that they were offering.
Is there a reason why you chose not to, or was it medically?
I could not, because I told the doctor that, of course, I'm not going to be okay. My son has died. And I told the doctor that I've never taken these pills. They gave me Valium. And if I take them now, when I don't understand what's happening with me, I don't think it's the wisest of things to do. So I still have my pill. Maybe one day I'll take it.
Maybe just for fun at some point. So when did you feel like during the mourning process or the grieving process that it actually hit you? Because you're speaking now about how you were confused, how you didn't really know what was happening, or your body was just kind of moving on an autopilot. And I think that's also our brain's way of protecting us from the news. But when do you think from that process that the grieving and the reality of the situation actually sunk in?
It sinks in with time, and with time, different things happen. The funeral itself was a huge, huge shifting in me. Mm-hmm. When we heard the service in the house for the first time, I cried for a long time, and it felt like the cry was bringing out something right from my gut, and it felt like I was taking out something that had been locked in there and needed to come out. And I was aware that I was wasting time and there wasn't much time. But that's what it felt like. That is what it felt like. I just let it out. And by the way, I had been at the funeral parlor. Mm-hmm. I had been with the uncles collecting the body, bringing it through to his home. And all of that had been done on that, in that mode of doing and so on. But when we sat down and I let it out, I think that did something, because in the funeral service at the church itself, I had this sense of real calm. And it's at that point I actually had this sense too that, and by the way, I will go to Mount Everest. I will go with Ricardo to Mount Everest. I will have my time with Ricardo to Mount Everest. So things, for me, things happened over time, even though it did not mean that this confusion, it came in spurts, almost as a shock that, by the way, my son is gone. And I would have this experience of like, by the way, my son is gone. And it would send me into a painful, painful spin. And that was something that was ongoing. But alongside, there would be positive things, decision to go up Mount Everest, to walk with Ricardo, to write. This is how it is even today. I walk with the unending pain of Ricardo's death. And yet there's a lot else that is alongside that. Mm-hmm. There's joy, there's laughter, there's a lot of love, there's lots of gifts there's lots of new learning. There's lots of newness. Mm-hmm. But that pain will never go.
Remember, it all continues over on the socials at @Lesego_Tlhabi. Now let's get back into convos and cocktails. Okay, so I just want to take a little detour and just ask you some of the questions that have to do with grief that I'd ask people to send in. And I know that you obviously don't have the professional answers. I don't think that some of these are maybe even going to be answerable for you because it's very specific.
Yeah.
But they are maybe just things that you can speak about from your own experience. Mm. So the first one was that there's a follower who also lost her son about in infancy. So she said she held her son and then he passed away. She said she doesn't ever think she's going to get over it. How did you get over it, basically? Or are you over it? I don't feel like that's a fair question. But
I think the idea of getting over it, we just must abandon it. Mm. I think we just put it to rest. Because there's no getting over it. There's no getting over it. It is an experience that has fundamentally shaken and changed us, and it continues to be that. So I don't even aim to get to a point where I can say I'm over it. I know that sometimes I will be able to do more. Even today, sometimes I just can't do anything. I just know that I need to attend to the grief I'm feeling today. And I try to get support from those around me to understand that today I can't. So it is going to be an ongoing thing. It's something that I must learn to hold. Mm-hmm. I don't think we should even aim to make sense of the terminology of getting over it when it comes to the grief.
Oh, this is not helpful. I feel like this is like one of the scariest, I think, anxieties that people have. And so hearing that is just like, oh no. But it is a truth. And I think that someone also described it as butter within a croissant, that they said you just learned to enjoy the butter and the dough and the pastry, but you never really get rid of that butter, if that makes sense. Yeah. So the second one says, how did you start to get used to the fact that you will never see them again? It is too painful.
The physical never seeing remains a painful thing, especially around poignant events such as Father's Day, birthdays, you know, just important days in our lives, coming together on Christmas and all of that is a real thing. Mm. But there are ways in which I personally keep Ricardo alive in me. The foundation that the family has founded is one place that I hold very, very dear, because it is the place where collectively we build on Ricardo's legacy.
Yeah.
And when we start doing the work and we start holding each other, we start seeing people supporting each other and responding to Ricardo's call for us to love each other, to care for each other, to give each other opportunities to value each other. Mm. When you start seeing that, it's almost like I see Ricardo smile. Fortunately, he left a lot that we look to remember him, the music, the archives that have a lot of him. So I remember him in that way and allow that to be real for me.
So I have a question personally, is when, you know, mourning on a public platform or with somebody that is so as famous as Ricardo was, what was that experience like for you? I feel like that must have been very invasive or very tough much more tough to deal with the fact that everywhere you turned, there he was, or there was an example of his music, or, you know, like you said. So how was the experience of kind of mourning in public?
To be honest with you, Sicho, what I very, very quickly saw and allowed to be significant to me is that there's a multitude of people who were touched by Ricardo, touched by his life, touched by what he did in life, and were grateful for that. And so almost from the first day, I realized this, and I had this sense that walking this path from now onwards is actually going to be alongside Ricardo's fans, alongside the many people who got to know of him and felt he had touched their lives, and he was a meaningful presence for them. And therefore, I had a huge opening that made it easy, for example, for me to post what I was writing, walking up Mount Everest, and share with the public.
Yeah.
And so the public grieving process was one that I embraced. I did have my own private moments, and I allowed myself to do a lot of private things, and family did a lot of private things. In time, what does come out, though, is that we grieve very, very differently. And even within the family, there were those who were deeply hurt by some of the public expressions of the grieving process, who would have been better served by sort of keeping some of our processes in a bubble.
Yeah.
And that's something to always be aware of, that as we grieve, we're not alone, there's all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to find ways of bringing all of us into the place of comfort, the place of feeling held as well. Yeah.
Okay, so there's a another person who lost their husband last month in June, and she's asking does she cope with telling the kids, or just helping the kids rather through it, because obviously they'd know by now, but helping them through it because they're quite young. And so I know obviously there were family members and Ricardo's children that were quite young.
Yeah.
How does one go about helping children navigate something like that?
I learned huge lessons from Bianca, and how she, right from day one, handled the communication with the children. One, it was clear, it was honest, it was not making any promises, but it was assuring as well. Assuring on aspects around things will remain largely unchanged. So because I think that's one huge anxiety that children encounter when they are faced with a significant loss. They almost see their lives unraveling. We also do that, but perhaps adults have ways of taking themselves through the processes of assuring themselves that some things are steady. But those are the things that children do need upfront, the assurances that, but not lies, honesty, assurances that their lives will not crumble. It's amazing how the passing of a parent would send children immediately to thoughts of, we won't be able to continue going to our school. We won't be able to continue living in our home. We probably would starve. Mommy would probably have to change this and move us there. All those things, they rush through the children's minds. So giving those assurances and the honesty, but also opening up opportunity for ongoing conversation. Mm. The children must know that the parent is not okay as well. the parent will try by all means to be present and supportive for their, of them. Parent is also not okay, but they are not responsible for making the parent okay.
Yeah.
The parent is there for them. They will all create an environment for themselves to be able to walk through the very difficult thing mm-hmm. that they all hold. So some, they must all contribute to shaping the rules, such as here we all can tell how we are feeling. We all can share how we are feeling. Yeah.
So obviously for you, you have four sons. And how does it, one of the other questions has to do with continuing as a mom, as a wife, as a, you know, at work mm-hmm. when you've lost one of your children, because one of our followers has spoken about how she doesn't feel like she can be the same mom to her kids with one having passed away. So how does that for you, showing up for them, but also for yourself during that process?
In the book, I talk about how my parenting would have negatively affected my children anyway. But what the process of grieving the loss of Ricardo has done is to open up more space for us to start talking. We are learning still to be in real communication, in constant communication with each other, to put feelings. We're not there. We're far from being there. But it is a hugely important healing process to learn how to share emotion, feeling, thought, just sharing where we are. So that thing of genuinely communicating and being vulnerable to each other in communication, it's a learning process. Many of us probably would start from already very flawed ground to do that. Yeah.
Okay. So the process, you know, of therapy and stuff like that, you've spoken about a lot that you have sorted out, and it seems that mental health is something that is, you know, was at your forefront, especially after Ricky's passing. Was that something that you were also aware of with Ricky's struggles with mental health?
Yeah, very much aware of the struggles, but what I was not aware of is what serves him best. I knew that he was aware of his struggles. I knew that he would take some steps to try and shore himself up. But what I still wish for to even today is that there had been some more meaningful, deeper process that would have exposed him to a sense that he can still go on. Yeah, I still wish for that.
I do want to speak more about, you know, the other parts of grief that you spoke about in the book, because it wasn't just the losing of Ricardo. I think you had three different moments of grief in your story and in your journey. Mm. What was that like, writing about those moments of deep grief that didn't have to necessarily do with the passing of someone?
Mm. I think grief not attended to is very, very dangerous for us. And my stories are about my failure to come to a time where I have been assisted to encounter my grief.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it had, throughout my life, it had been a process of shutting things up and trying to cope. One of the things that I did in my attempts to cope, especially after the home invasion in 1989, was, sorry, not 1989, in 1998, one of the things that I started doing was to just search for meaning, spiritual journeys, really looking for things that would make this sense of disturbance that just was overwhelming inside of me to calm down. And so I did open up to do a lot of studying of the human psyche, me and being connected to others, me in relationship. I was really interested in exploring how to heal that. But without the actual story being the center of all these processes, I needed to continue searching and searching and searching. I never came to a place where I felt, I know what I'm dealing with. I know I'm on a path towards peace. I'm feeling that sense of peace. It was quite elusive. It would come and go. Yeah.
That's, your story is very incredible. So for me, I want to speak a little bit about the other side of grief. But as you said, there's no real other side, but just the fact that you're able to publish a book, the fact that you're able to speak about Ricardo today, or just those moments of joy. There are moments of light. There are moments of laughter. When did you feel the first time like that was starting to happen for you again?
And that's called growth. They call it post-grief growth. In fact, somebody put it very nicely. It was a young person who put it very nicely just a few days ago. They said, time doesn't really heal us. And time doesn't really reduce the grief. We sort of grow while we are in grief. So that growth then makes us and many other aspects of us to stand in prominence, even though the grief is also part of us, but other parts we stand prominently. And for me, the sense that that was happening came through when I realized that I had stayed in therapy for 3 months, going to therapy every week. And when I realized that the surfacing of the suppressed memory was shattering, but I was able to walk with it. And I was able to walk with the different waves that came out of it. And so being able to walk with it meant I was getting the necessary assistance as my challenges came up, and I put them to the fore, and I got the guided to where I must go for assistance. So I had different forms of therapy, body work. I had all sorts of meditative processes that I went through. And so, yeah, that for me was growth, because I didn't sit in a place and close it up and hope that I'll cope with it.
So what would you say then would be the best ways of dealing with grief? Is that through therapy, or would you say that there are different forms of, like you said, there's different forms of therapy? How best would someone find the best way to deal with grief for themselves?
Sikho, I have to say this, that when we talk about therapy and my experience, this is not the guidance for everybody. I'm talking therapy, sitting down with professionals in the psychotherapy field. I am talking about exposure to plant medicine. I'm talking about exposure to different forms of therapy which might not be conventionally taken up and recorded in that book that guides psychotherapists, the DSM, psychotherapists and psychiatrists. But there are many, many forms that have not been surfaced and referred to in the manner that they deserve to be held. And these are mainly associated with ways in which different communities deal with rupture, yeah, with things breaking up in community, things breaking up in people's lives and bringing them back together. So in communities, having elders, having circles of young people, circles of peers, having rituals that open ourselves up without even talking to releasing the things that are holding us, having rituals that connect us to places of our own sense-making. These are very, very important ways of us making sense of life and healing. Mm-hmm. Some of the traumas that we experience. So I'm not saying, when I'm telling my story, that this is almost the blueprint for, yeah, walking the journey of grief. We are all, shaped by different experience, cultures, and what is available to us. And also, when I talk about the mainstream psychotherapy based on Western schooling and training, remember that this is hardly accessible, mm, even from a cost a point of view, hardly accessible even from the presence of facilities. There's limited facilities across just our country as well. So that is something to bear in mind. And so let us all understand how we find those spaces that are safe, that open us up to engaging with our true selves, our true experiences, whether it's walking in the forest, whether it's just going home and walking the lands that our fathers and mothers walked, and relating to ourselves in deeper ways. Let's do that.
All right, so the last thing to speak about, obviously, is the artivism and the foundation. This is something that obviously you guys started after Ricky's passing. Can you tell us a little bit about when you decided to start a foundation and maybe the reasons behind it?
Ricardo had been talking to us for some time about something that would take the work that he had been doing over time of supporting young people, mm, helping them through their paths towards realizing their full talents and making life beautiful and meaningful to them. And he was not very impressed with the ways in which we had worked in the organizations that we had worked in before, and he was very clear that we are not really effective. But he did embrace the idea of bringing some organizing into the work of supporting others, helping others, promoting this essence of love through what we do and sharing our talents. So that's when the seed is planted, and when he passes, then we start the discussion and we allow ourselves to have this percolate, and we sit on it, and we finally arrive at a place where we say we have a sense of how the foundation might operate, and we are saying that we want it to embrace certain principles, such as promoting volunteerism, being based on that culture of volunteer and giving, and that it must definitely cover the focus of supporting mental health and well-being, cover the focus of supporting young people and ensuring that they are brought into the fold and they are able to pass it forward and just spread this movement of loving and caring for each other and sharing talents through that. That then ties into the work that we are also doing globally of energizing artivism, which is the bringing together of art, culture, and activism, which is using then these artistic skills and exposure for the change that we want to see in society, and therefore engaging communities in this work.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for sharing a little bit about, you know, your experience through grief and your story about Ricky. Is there anything that you have coming up next, or, you know, something that you're looking forward to in your journey that you want to share or that you're going to share?
Well, at this point, I would say there is a lot that is being worked, not ready to be shared, but certainly when it's ready for sharing, we will use the Ricky Rick Foundation for the promotion of artivism and its website to share a lot of the developments that are coming through. Second book, I do have a sense that there is more writing that will come. I don't know what form it is going to come in. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Well, thank you very much for sharing your day and your time with us and your story. And thank you for the cider. This has been very delicious.
Thank you.
Cheers.
All the best.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for joining us on another episode of Convos and Cocktails. Your guest has been Aunt Louisa Zondo, the author of Dearest Mariki, A Mother's Journey Through Grief, Trauma and Healing. See you next time. Goodbye. Season 3 Convos and Cocktails, produced by Lesucho Tlhabi and WMG, and recorded at Vodcast TV Studios. Remember, this podcast is streamable on Spotify and other major streaming platforms.